evening, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course you're out there across America. Why, we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being because we have with us on the line Sue Schur, and we're going to be talking about, we're going to be talking about vaccines. And, of course, we've already done two programs today on vaccines, and so we're going to have 2 hours again this evening. But you just can't discuss this too much, and not only that, in the 2 hours we've already had, we've only really scratched the surface. And so, Sue, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Dr. Stan.
So, did you hear either of the other programs we did?
No, I didn't.
All right, fine. Well, then you could just go ahead and say whatever you want to. You don't have to worry about being repetitive. But we had Dr. Blaylock on. We had Sherry Tenpenny. But these are an entirely different audience we're talking about tonight. So let me just introduce the subject with our listeners up in the great Northwest and the state of Washington. And that is, of course, if you're like most people, why, you've been told for many years that one of the great advantages of the modern-day medicine is vaccines. And it's done a wonderful job doing away with childhood diseases and polio and smallpox. And isn't this really wonderful? We've transformed the world. And the reason people are healthier today is because of vaccines. Well, of course, the reason that people are healthier today is because certainly we have far better nutrition. We have cleaner water. We have good living conditions. And it's sort of like fluoride, you know. They say, look, the teeth are so much better today than because of fluoride. And yet if you compare fluoridated and non-fluoridated areas with children's teeth, and you're honest, you'll find out that the children do worse in the fluoridated than the non-fluoridated areas. So we've got a problem. Sometimes perception is different than reality. And so Sue is going to be with us today because she's on the front lines of this battle. And, of course, we could take each one of the major so-called advances and give them a careful consideration and find out that there are real problems, and not only with what we've been told, but with the end result of vaccination. And as we look and we see the incidence of autism going from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 250, sometimes 1 in 150 children. This is a devastating condition. And perhaps, and then, of course, we see more and more children with behavioral problems, and we see the incidence of juvenile diabetes doubling, and the incidence of autoimmune disease in children, and asthma increasing, and certainly childhood susceptibility to allergies. All of these things are increasing, and the question is why? And, of course, they are not going to answer the question why, because they don't want you to question what you're being told. And I'm not criticizing the average doctor. The average doctor has never heard what you're going to hear this evening. So, Sue, let me play the devil's advocate, and let me point out how much better off we are today that since we've had these vaccines and what a wonderful job they've done and how much healthier our children are here in America because of the vaccines, say, compared with children in Africa where they don't have vaccines. How are you going to respond to that?
Well, number one, when we started the mandatory vaccination program, when we started expanding it in the 50s and 60s, there was a Rutgers University study done, and these scientists said you're going to trade measles and mumps for cancer and leukemia. And that's exactly what has happened in this country, and we are not healthier, especially for the amount of money that we spend. And there's quite a lot of vaccination going on through the World Health Organization in Africa. And I have a friend who's in a peace peacemaking program at
Like Peace Corps or what?
Well, it's an actual degree. It's called International Peacemaking, and it's at Eastern Mennonite University in Harrisonburg, Virginia. People come from all over the world, and she has several colleagues that are from Africa, and she showed me a picture of, I forget exactly what country it was, but these African women were holding up a sign, food and water, yes, vaccines, no. And the World Health Organization, you know, Lori Garrett, she talked about the worldwide vaccination programs, and she said in some areas where they have to vaccinate by gunpoint because these people are supposedly so primitive, they don't get how this is going to help them. But our vaccine programs have literally wiped out, except for a few individuals, a whole tribe in the Amazons.
How did the vaccines wipe them out?
Well, they were administered, and everybody died except a few individuals.
Well, you think that might make some people a little bit suspicious. In fact, the latest studies in Africa by a man named Gesselquist, I think it was, and of course he was challenging what everybody is told, that AIDS is primarily a sexually transmitted disease. And of course, he presented his material to the Royal Society in London, so he's obviously a very reliable individual. He pointed out that, of course, in many children who are HIV positive, their mother is not HIV positive, and they didn't get it by, these are in, young children, 6, 7, 8 years old, they didn't get it from sexual contact. Some studies, 41% of children who are HIV positive, their mother isn't. And he pointed out that this is much more prevalent in the southern part of Africa, in Botswana, and Swaziland, and Lesotho, and Saudi, and South Africa, where they spend a lot more money on health, and where the rate of HIV and AIDS is the highest in the world. And he hypothesized that it was coming from the use of dirty needles in that area. In other words, they were reusing the needles over and over again. And that's how the children were getting HIV positive. Well, I practice in South Africa, and I can tell you that they have a very advanced form of medicine there. They don't reuse the needles. And, of course, the question is, could it possibly be something in the vaccine that has got to a situation today? We're in Botswana, and I have the latest statistics. I just got them a couple of days ago. In Botswana, of the adult population, 42% are HIV positive, and they're all going to die. Of course, in the cities in South Africa, this is the low-risk population. 38% are HIV positive, and they're going to die in the major cities of South Africa. Do you think that just happened by accident? And there's some people, and I think there are a lot of Africans who believe that it was something was put in those vaccines that brought about what's going on. Now, that's another question, but I can understand why many people really don't trust the vaccines that they're being given. We know that in China today, there are 700 million people who have had hepatitis B or are actually carrying hepatitis B. How did they get it? Why the vaccine programs, and in China, they did use the needles over and over again. There are almost between 150 and 200 million people throughout the world with hepatitis C, and most of them got it from using dirty needles to give vaccinations. And now, of course, we're here to help. We want to give you more vaccines. Yeah, no wonder people are beginning to say, well, maybe these vaccinations are not being given to help us.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe it's not the dirty needles. Maybe it's something in the vaccines.
Well, we know, for instance, that in the Philippines and in Kenya, they put an abortifact in there, so women would have abortions. I've talked to doctors from both the Philippines and Kenya, and they confirm that, and they've had the material tested. So if they would put things in the vaccines to keep people from having children, what else could they put in the vaccines?
Well, something to perhaps eliminate a certain race, as suggested by a man down here in San Diego, has filed a lawsuit here.
I know. But tell me about that. I'm not quite sure what that's about.
Well, he says he has a paper trail similar to what Dr. Leonard Horowitz has.
Is that Boyd Graves?
Yes, I think so.
All right, fine. I know Boyd, and he's got a lot of information, and there is a great deal of evidence that this is a race-specific virus, at least HIV is. But that's, of course, my latest newsletter. You'll have to get that.
Yeah.
Well, let's go through some of the specific vaccines. Let's take polio. Now, polio is a terrible disease. You know, when I was first getting into orthopedic surgery, you know, you'd see these children and they'd have, you know, legs that were shriveled and wasted. Certainly you'd have their backs would be collapsed from scoliosis. I mean, there were people, I remember when I first came to town here, there was a doctor. He had been a surgeon and a very effective, successful doctor. He got polio. And, of course, he had to live in a lung. Initially, it was an iron lung, but eventually it was one of these portable situations. But it was a respirator because he didn't have any muscles to breathe with. Isn't doing away with polio been a wonderful thing? So how would you counter that when we tell you all the good that the polio vaccine has done?
Well, polio actually increased in several areas after the introduction of the vaccine. Jonas Salk himself was, although there was a race to come up with the vaccine that would be chosen by the federal government for the vaccine programs, there was a race between Jonas Salk, Albert Sabin, and Hillary Koprowski, and a few other minor players. There was a rush to judgment, I think. Some of the, you know, some of the trials they had. Are you still with me, Dr.?
I'm still with you here.
So. Okay. They had some difficulty with the trials, but because the public, because they felt the public wanted this, because they had hyped it so much that they were on the trail of a cure. And because they had taken so much money from the public, they felt like they had to produce this product. So they brought it out on the market even before Jonas Salk was very comfortable with it. And there's a book out called Trial by Fury by Aaron Klein, and it goes into the politics of the early polio vaccine introduction. And at that same time, the Koprowski vaccine, according to AIDS activist Tom Curtis, was introducing the HIV virus to what is now the epicenter of the AIDS explosion would be Rwanda and Burundi. And at the time that Koprowski was doing his vaccine trials, it was the Belgian Congo. And he had 400,000 subjects. They didn't follow up on any of them. And right after this vaccine trial happened, the Belgian Congo erupted in the revolution. And it's been an area of violence ever since.
Well, now, are you suggesting that there was the HIV virus was in the Congo? That was given the vaccine that was given in the Congo. Is there any actual proof of that? In other words, have they ever gotten any of the vaccine and actually tested it? Because there was a man named Edward Hooper who wrote a book called The River that had that contention in it, that the AIDS epidemic in Africa came from the polio vaccination. And, of course, when they got the vaccine and tested it, they couldn't find any virus. What about what you're talking about? Did they ever actually identify the virus in the Rwanda area?
Well, they've identified it as a...
But I'm talking in the vaccine.
No, because Tom Curtis and others were demanding that the original vaccine stocks be tested, and they're refusing to do that. I think Koprowski was with Wistar Institute, and they refused to allow the vaccine stocks to be tested.
Now, what year was that? Do you have any idea what year you're talking about?
What
year they gave the vaccine?
What year?
Yes.
I think it was it was in the 50s, I think. Kaprowski was testing his vaccine at the same time Sabin and Salk were.
So he tested his vaccine in Africa.
Yes.
Right.
And he had a much larger trial. He had 400,000 people.
But the trouble is the vaccine, the epidemic didn't hit Africa until the early 80s, or at least the mid-70s.
Well, it's a retrovirus, and it had, you know, originally they were saying AIDS had a 10 and 20-year incubation period.
The average 10 years.
Okay, well, that would, you know, it. I can't remember the specifics, but Tom Curtis is the one that came up with this theory originally.
Okay, well, we
and the time frame was right, and the epicenter of the AIDS epidemic is the same area that he did his testing in. So that was what you would say anecdotal evidence. But then Edwin Hooper came along, and he actually interviewed all the players involved, and he pretty much found out that they were using chimpanzee kidney tissue for growing their vaccines, the Kaprowski vaccine.
Right.
And they were hiding it. It was something that, you know, they had hypothesized that chimpanzee kidneys were, chimpanzees were too close to humans.
All right. Well, I think that the major thing, of course, from the point of view of the polio vaccine, at least as far as the United States is concerned, is the fact that in the original vaccine, and that's the Salk vaccine, they've rushed it onto the market. And of course, there was, and the story, have you ever read the book, The Health Century by Edward Sorter?
No, I want to.
If I could suggest you get that book, it's one of the most important books in my library. And Edward Sorter was just a journalist. He was hired by NIH, the National Institute of Health, to write a book about the wonderful job that the National Institute had done. And so, of course, he was an honest man, and I will give him credit for that. So he told the story of the polio vaccine. It's there. The book is authorized by the NIH. So initially, they're going to put this vaccine on the market, the Salk vaccine. It's 1955. And, of course, there's a woman named Bernice Eddy, and she is a virologist. She works for NIH. And her job is to test all of the vaccine to make it sure it's perfectly safe. She tests the vaccine. She injects it into monkeys. And the cutter vaccine gives the monkeys polio when they're dying and they're getting paralyzed. So she reports this to the head of the NIH, and she said there are two types of vaccine that are all right, but the cutter vaccine has live virus in it. You give it, people are going to get polio. So what happened? Why, of course, they came around and they offered her free vaccination shots for her family and herself, and she couldn't believe it. And they released the cutter vaccine, and almost 100 people died, and I don't know how many people got paralyzed. And then, of course, when it came out, exactly what had happened, why Bernice Eddy, instead of being promoted, was actually, of course, chastised and demoted, and she was sent to a part of the NIH where they were studying cancer viruses, which is, at that time, sort of a dead end. So then, of course, 5 years goes by, and Bernice Eddy is still smarting a little bit from this, and of course she's not allowed to work with polio vaccine anymore because she found out that, of course, the cutter vaccine was infected, and of course it led to, the Secretary of Health and Education having to resign, and, everybody was very, very humiliated because they knew that the vaccine was contaminated, and they allowed it to go out. So then, of course, she gets into this laboratory one night. She starts looking at the cultures of the kidney of the rhesus monkey where the vaccine is being grown, and she notices that there's something strange there, something very strange. The cells are dying, and she has some of this. She takes it back to her lab, and she finally decides there's a cancer virus in the polio vaccine we've given to about 80 or 90 million Americans. And eventually, since she tells her chief he won't pay any attention to her, she goes to a medical meeting, she announces this, and of course, you know, this gets into at least the scientific press. There is a cancer virus that we've given to 80 to 90 million people. And eventually, of course, Dr. Hillerman, who worked for Merck, confirmed what she said, It was a virus that was known as SV40, a simian virus 40. But when they found it, of course, they couldn't tell the American people that, because after all, how are you going to justify what you've done, that you hurried this on the market without adequate study? And so they, well, two of the companies pulled their vaccine off the market, and two of them they continued giving until all the supplies were gone. And then, of course, they had to come up with some other means of growing the polio virus, so they decided to shift from the rhesus monkey to the green monkey. And that's exactly what they did. And about that time, the Sabin vaccine was ready to go. And so they shifted from the salt vaccine to the Sabin vaccine. Then they shifted from the rhesus monkey to the African green monkey. And they continued growing the polio vaccine in the kidney cultures until about 1972, when somebody said, "Do you think maybe we ought to find out if the green monkeys have any viruses that might affect people?" And when they, 1972, they found that there were all sorts of viruses that they were giving people from the green monkeys, then they said, well, nobody seems to be dying, and we can't tell the people that, and we sure can't tell them. We gave 90 million Americans a cancer virus, and of course, so they kept that secret too, and of course, that is, of course, these they call them stealth viruses, and probably this is why so many people are developing diseases and cancers now. They've known this all along, and they've simply lied to us. The first part of the story is all in the book Health Century, published with the full support of the NIH. The second part is, of course, in Dr. Blaylock's book on the health and nutrition secrets that can save your life, and in my newsletter, I believe it's the July newsletter of last year, which we'll be glad to send to any of our listeners. And people have to really begin to understand what's going on, and they're not getting the truth from regular channels.
You know, at the last National Vaccine Information Conference, there was an African man who had a television station, and he started protesting every so often in the country he was in, they would have vaccination campaigns, and everybody has to get a shot, even if they've, and it's usually, there's a lot of polio vaccine campaigns. And even if they've just had one, within the last year. And he organized some protest, and the government basically shut him down. They made the cost, I think his station license cost about $10,000 per year, and they ran the price up very high and basically put him out of business after that.
Well, that's because, of course, the American government puts pressure on them, and they're going to withhold the aid, and, of course, all of these countries there are dependent upon American aid, and they're just cut off the aid unless those countries go along with our program. The trouble is it's killing the people there.
Yeah. You know, at the National Vaccine Information Conference 3 years ago, there was an attorney there by the name of Jim Turner, and he was one of the original Nader's Raiders. And back in the days when health education and welfare was the cabinet post, not health and human services like we have today. And Elliot Richardson was the secretary of HUE, and he asked Jim, who was a young man just out of law school at that time, he asked him to go over to the a Bureau of Biological Standards, which has a lot to do with vaccines, and find out what was going on over there. He says, I don't know what these people do, and there's something funny about them. I can't, they're under me, but I can't get anything out of them. So he kind of was a hanger on there for, he'd have lunch with them and that type of thing for several months, and they would talk about wastage with these vaccine programs. They knew ahead of time that there were going to be deaths in our mandatory vaccine program.
No, and they were going to be what now?
Deaths.
Deaths, you mean, okay. In other words, it was going to kill people.
Yes. And
kill children.
Kill children. And last time I was on your program, I talked about the TORCH study, where they connected 70% of SIDS to within 3 weeks of a DPT shot. And that was correlated by Vera Scribner's study showing stress-induced breathing patterns within 24 hours after a DPT shot and, you know, continuing on after that.
And, of course, what you're saying is that the sudden infant death syndrome, or SID, there was a study that showed a very definite relationship between the DPT shots and the SID, the death of the child. And, of course, SID has been increasing fairly regularly, and they keep saying, oh, well, you put the child on the stomach, or that's the reason. And, of course, they will do everything they can to conceal the fact that many of these children have just had a vaccine. In fact, would you like to talk about the shaken baby syndrome and how people actually have been sent to prison in this country whose children died immediately or very shortly after having vaccines? And rather than, of course, accept the fact it's a vaccine, why they say, well, obviously it was parental abuse, they killed their child, they're going to go to prison. And some of them have been sent to prison for life, imprisonment, when it was actually a vaccine reaction. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, just like in the 70s, where when SIDS was a was the wastebasket that they would throw vaccine deaths in, and then they had Munchausen syndrome by proxy for that was in vogue for a few years, and in the 90s, particularly starting in 1991 or 92. After the introduction of the hepatitis B vaccine, we started experiencing an explosion in shaken baby syndrome.
At least that's what they call it, shaken baby syndrome.
Yes, and in my opinion, it's just another wastebasket for vaccine-induced trauma or post-vaccinal trauma or a closed brain injury after vaccination.
And of course what happens is these children get increased intracerebral pressure, and that's why they have the high-pitched cry, and they may get convulsions, and then they may get bleeding in the brain, and then they die. And then of course, you see, the whole thing is that the public health establishment justifies its very existence on all the lives we've saved from vaccines. And any effort to point out that there may be danger in some vaccines and that there are some reactions to it is immediately covered up. And tell us the story of the British nanny. I think probably most of our listeners have heard that story. Have you ever been able to actually verify any more of that than we last time we talked?
I haven't sent it to you, but yes, I have verified it. I actually talked to one of the paralegals who was working on a shaken baby defense here in San Diego. And she was, you know, she talked to Barry Schecht.
Now, Barry Schecht, for our listeners, is a lawyer who will take almost any case. He was on part of the O.J. Simpson defense. But he's also, a very, very shrewd lawyer. And just because he was part of the O.J. Simpson defense doesn't necessarily make him a bad person. He could be a very good person, but maybe he didn't believe that O.J. didn't do it, and maybe who knows, maybe he was right. But be that as it may, so Barry Schecht is a very prominent lawyer, and why don't you tell the story, because I think that's so amazing, because I've never heard it before, but I'm afraid we're running out of time here, and we're going to be here in just a moment. We'll have to take our half-hour break, and I'm a little embarrassed that I missed our other break, but of course I'm sure the computer up in the Great Northwest didn't. We'll be back here in just a moment. We'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Sue Scherer, and we're talking about, of course, vaccinations and, of course, the things that you're not going to hear through regular channels about vaccines. And I dare say that most of our listeners have not heard the story we've told earlier about, of course, the cancer virus that we gave, the SV40, and this is one reason why we're having so many cancers today, and they find it with mesotheliomas, and they're, I believe, brain tumors. There's two or three other specific tumors that you can produce in animals with SV40, and now, of course, we're growing them in all the human beings, but, of course, we can't let the human beings know that, because then they wouldn't trust the people who put the vaccines out. Think of the potential for lawsuits, especially when so many of the tumors we're finding today, mesotheliomas, have the SV40 in it that we know is a cancer-producing virus. It was the first cancer-producing virus in human beings. The first cancer-producing virus identified, and then it became the basis of so much other information and led to the whole field of genetic engineering. In fact, the first virus that they ever took apart to look at its genetic makeup was SV40. And, of course, a large percentage of the American people carry that. And if you doubt what we're saying, the story is told in my June newsletter last year. My July newsletter last year. If you have a computer, go to radioliberty.com and pull it down. And if you don't have a computer, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And ask specifically for the July 2000 newsletter. We'll be glad to send it to you. And I think it's vitally important that you have the information. And then, of course, don't take what I say. Check the facts. We've talked certainly extensively with Dr. Martin, who used to work for the FDA, certainly about the viruses that came from the green monkeys. Did you ever wonder why the FDA recently, about 2 years ago, switched from the Sabin vaccine back to the Salk vaccine? Oh, they said it's because the Sabin vaccine, we were getting, you know, 3 or 4 cases of polio in America every year from the virus going wild. Well, that wasn't the real reason at all. The real reason was because they knew there were all these other monkey viruses in there. There was no way they could kill them without killing the polio virus. And so they knew they were continuing to give Americans all these monkey viruses. And so they switched back to the Sabin because, of course, that is, pardon me, back to the Salk vaccine because that is a situation where the virus is actually killed by formalin. At least, hopefully, it is. So go ahead and pick up the story from there about the shaken baby syndrome and about the nanny case, which was so famous. And I'm sure most of your listeners remember hearing about this British nanny who shook this little baby to death and it died. And, of course, she said, I didn't shake the baby at all. But, of course, she was convicted, and then the judge overturned the verdict and let her go home. So what's the real story?
Her name was Louise Woodward, and she was from Manchester, England. She was 18 or 19, and she was the nanny for, I think his name was Matthew Epen. And she did say that she shook the baby to because he was not breathing, so she shook him, but not violently. However, and she said, I popped him on the bathroom floor. Well, the policeman that took her testimony, he was reproducing her what she said. But in England, when you say popped, you just mean placed. And they totally ignored her explanation of, I was trying to rouse the baby. I didn't do anything violent to him. And this is similar to other shaken baby cases where the father will say, well, I put the baby on the bed and I jostled him, you know, to rouse him.
Now, how soon after the vaccination did the death occur? Do we have any idea?
I'm not sure in this case, but, you know, there's a delayed hypersensitivity with vaccines. And
it's usually within a period of a couple of weeks, isn't it?
Yes, usually, yes. Usually you notice something. And the TORCH study, for example, went up to 3 weeks. There's a three-week window there where, there was a cluster of SIDS. But at any rate, Lorraine was convicted by the jury, even though her defense brought up this vaccine defense. This data that that the vaccine that Matthew was given could and does cause collapse and death, apnea and collapse. Now what's unusual about that is not so much that it was presented. The jury didn't believe it, you know, because the prosecutor had his witnesses, his expert witnesses. However, what was really interesting is that the media didn't even report this, and it was an ongoing story with every day. What do you think? What do you think? Did she do it? Did she not do it? Well, how do we know?
Well, Chris, you mean, did they present a vaccine defense to your knowledge? In other words, did they actually try to bring
yes.
this out of the trial, and the media totally ignored that?
Totally ignored it. And that, and in the case down here in San Diego, they didn't present it. They didn't present the vaccine defense because they were watching the Woodward case, and the jury convicted her even after hearing the vaccine defense. So they didn't present the vaccine defense because they thought it would prejudice the jury.
Well, I think, of course, what we have to do is get this information out. I mean, I've talked to a fellow, I think he was given 30 years in prison for killing his son. It's horrible enough to lose your child, and then, of course, to be put in prison. And when, of course, it wasn't, it came from the vaccination, but they can't admit that. I mean, after all, if we admitted that, people would begin to question what we're doing here.
Yeah, vaccine acceptance is what they call it in the medical journals. They write lots of articles on vaccine acceptance.
And of course, there are these resistors, like people like you, who object to this, or you probably are some sort of a health food nut. Or in fact, I was listening to Dr. Sherry Tenpenny's video last night, and she was talking about these articles that appear in the media, you know, for the doctors, of course, defaming people who, of course, don't want to have the vaccines for their children, as if they're somehow nuts or psychopath or, you know, or these extremists because they object to the vaccination. Well, I think if the doctors were told the truth, they'd object to it as well.
Well, in fact, 91% of obstetricians refuse the rubella shot.
For their own family?
Yes, and for themselves, and they are, the nurses who are employees in hospitals are required, especially if they work in the OB unit, they're required to get numerous rubella vaccines. And there's a group of nurses that have chronic fatigue from, you know, repeated rubella vaccinations. And it's called chronic fatigue syndrome. I'm sorry, I can't remember it, but it's out of Idaho. So there was a whole group of nurses a generation ago that had chronic fatigue. There's another group of nurses here in California is where it's headquartered, and it's Hep B vaccine injured nurses, and they have various they have a paralysis, various chronic fatigue, various illnesses from hepatitis B vaccine.
And of course, nurses are required by law to take that, and of course, do they have a website, the hepatitis B vaccine injured nurses?
Yeah, if you, I don't know the website, but if you punch in the search engine, Sherry, S-H-E-R-R-I, last name Naken, N-A-K-K-E-N, you'll find it.
All right, we will. And let's go to Theodora, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Theodora, how are you?
Dr. Stan and your guest. I have a question. I'm concerned. I remember, it might have been a show that you did, Dr. Stan, where you were talking with an African person who was involved with challenging the measles vaccines in Africa and how many children were being killed by that. And I wonder if your guest knows anything about it. I know it's a program of the Red Cross, and I have a friend of the Red Cross that I've been wanting to educate about that. And I don't know where to get more information, and perhaps your guest knows.
Do you know anything about it, Sherry? I'm really not acquainted with that at all. There must have been another program theater.
Okay.
Theater, but have you ever heard anything about that?
No, I haven't.
But Theodora, I'm not surprised. But of course, there is a very there's an attitude among the elite that Africans are expendable.
Well, I truly know that, and that's why I needed to have more information besides just what I could remember from the program.
Well, I'll tell you what, if I could suggest the vaccine, the Vaccine Information Center, Barbara Cole Fisher, I think it is, Barbara Lowe Fisher, you can call me off the air and I can get you her telephone number. And of course, she knows everybody. She's on the front line of this. And perhaps Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and we can put you in touch with her as well. Because I think it's important. I mean, I feel so saddened by what's going on in Africa today. These people are all dying. I mean, when you're talking about the population, the adult population of Botswana, 42% are HIV positive of the adults, and that's the low risk. When you get in the high risk, it's really high. And in South Africa, 38% in the major cities are HIV positive. They're all going to die. One of the greatest catastrophes of all time. And what are we doing? We're passing out condoms. We're not trying to stop the epidemic. We're going to let it run its course, and it's going to kill all those people. And either we have the a public health policy that is a terrible disaster and a failure, or we have a very successful genocide policy, and I simply ask you, which is it?
Well, after listening to your show for so many years, Dr. Stan, I have no doubt it's the latter.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, fine.
Yeah. I would like to talk about a couple of other diseases that most people don't associate with vaccines.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, diabetes for one. And there's an excellent research done by Bart Klassen, MD. And he connects diabetes with vaccination. And he's a former NIH employee. And I can give you his website in a minute. Also, heart disease. That's the number one killer in this country. The second would be cancer, and ever since Nixon started the war on cancer, we've been losing it. But heart disease, most people don't associate with vaccines. But, you know, you hear about these young athletes dying of heart attack at age 20, and here they are, the picture of health. But vaccine viruses can lodge in your heart and cause myopathy.
Now you're talking about the live viruses were given, like the measles virus and certainly the rubella and the mumps virus, or are you talking about the passenger viruses that we've given to so many people, the monkey viruses, both from the rhesus and the green monkey? Which virus is
I'm talking about the intended viruses.
All right. And, of course, they're live viruses, and the whole idea, of course, is why you're going to give them, and then the body will mobilize and kill them. But about an awful lot of those viruses live. I know we were talking earlier today, and Dr. Blaylock was saying about 20% of the measles viruses live, and then they go into your central nervous system, and they get in those cells there, and they begin to produce all sorts of problems and progressive degenerative neurological disease. Now, which of the viruses is goes to the heart?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, different. They're not. It's not all that specific all the time. For example, all the seven original vaccine viruses or vaccines can have seizure-producing toxins. That's the DPT, the MMR, and the polio. All have seizure-producing toxins. And hepatitis B vaccine can cause seizures. There you go. MMR is usually associated with autism, but the DPT shot, those viruses can end up in the gut and cause autism.
Now, wait a minute. DPT, diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, those are bacteria, but certainly the pertussis is a, there's a toxin that can very well, it's the toxin in pertussis that really gets the problems, but those are bacteria as such.
Yes, okay.
At least there shouldn't be any viruses in there. But
yeah, I'm sorry. I meant the microorganisms.
Okay, fine.
Okay. And
So, and also, any vaccine can cause meningitis. Any vaccination can leave you with meningitis because it's vaccination in general reduces your immune response, and meningitis is an opportunistic organism, and you can get meningitis. And meningitis is rampant right now on our college campuses. And these kids that, go to college, you don't think you're going to be sent to the infirmary for your shots, but they are. There's a series of shots that are required now for college-age students.
And, of course, it seems like we have this idea that we can solve every problem with another vaccine. And, of course, they want to give people vaccinations for meningococcal meningitis and for pneumococcus. And there are about 20 or 30 more vaccines in addition to all the other vaccines we're already giving these children. And every time you do, you insult the immune system just a little bit more.
Yeah, and to illustrate the heart disease, just with this is anecdotal evidence, but it's very dramatic. If you remember, I think George Bush Sr., his Secretary of Defense was Les Aspin, and it was announced on the news that he's going to go to the Middle East on a fact-finding mission. So he's getting his shots now because he's going to the Middle East in a couple of weeks. Okay, then a few days later, the White House announces, his trip is canceled because he's ill. He can't go anywhere. He's ill. So cancel that Middle East trip. Then a few weeks later, he's in the hospital. He's got major heart stuff going on, and then a couple of months later, he needs a pacemaker. And short time after that, years maybe, about the time that there was a change of, I think he worked for Clinton. Les Aspin actually worked for Clinton for a number of years. So he was a holdover from the Bush administration. But he died. He died at quite a young age.
Well, I'm much more concerned with the boys that's in the first Gulf War. I mean, here you have 700,000
yes.
boys. 200,000 of them are presently ill. Now, these are young, healthy people. They're in their late 20s or early 30s. Now, these were the boys we sent overseas. 10,000 of them are dead. 200,000 of them are ill. And, of course, why? I mean, they got multiple shots. Of course, some of them probably were exposed to depleted uranium, and some of them were exposed to all the other experiments they did, the radiostigmine and the other thing. But a lot of these kids got multiple vaccinations. Now, and I believe that they were experimenting on them, that those of you who have not yet read the Rockefeller Committee report, you need to get it. It's only, I think, $9.95. The official government report was put out by the Veterans Administration telling about how the government has experimented on hundreds of thousands of Americans without their knowledge or consent. But it specifically talks about the Gulf War syndrome, about the infectious component, and then, of course, the large number of boys. 200,000 American boys who went overseas to fight a 100-hour war, 100 casualties, great victory, and now 200,000 of them are ill. The article by Colonel Hackworth is up on tbrnews.com. That's the Barnes News, tbrnews.org, I guess it is, tbrnews.com or org. I'm not sure which one it is. And get Colonel Hacksworth's article talking about almost 200,000 boys, and I believe a lot of it was multiple shots that they got and what was in those shots. And the government says, why, there's absolutely nothing wrong with them. There is no Gulf War syndrome. But now, of course, some of them are getting disability. I mean, I think that everybody should realize that they experimented with those vaccines. At least that was part of the story. And, of course, but where is the outcry? Why, it's deafening and it's silence. If you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you have any question or comment. Well, I would love to hear from you. So what about some of the other vaccines that we have, Sue? What about the this one for Haemophilus influenza?
I actually don't know too much about that one.
Now, this
because
is
it came after
one.
My son, you know, at the point my son had his reaction, I just stopped. And that came after his reaction.
All right, fine. And there's so many new vaccines that have come out since then. Why don't you tell our listeners what happened to your son? Because I think that sometimes, you know, we can talk all the theory, but of course, when you hear about what happened to one child, it makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah, well, my son was born healthy, normal. His Apgar scores went right up to 10 within a few seconds, and or 9 point something, 9.8 or whatever. And he was nursed. I nursed him, and at 6 weeks old, he was doing fine. He was thriving and growing, and I took him in for his well baby visit. I was surprised to know that it was a routine DPT and oral polio was in order, and it took a little bit of convincing, but you know, they assured me at that age. I was 26 at that time, and I basically did what people told me to do, and I didn't feel good about it. You know, he was such a little thing. And when I was a kid, I don't remember my brothers and sisters ever getting shots at that young of an age, and that many at one time.
About 6 weeks or so, or how old was he?
Yeah, was between 6 and 7 weeks old.
Okay.
And he was a little fussy that night, and then the next day he was just very stressed out. He wanted to be held all the time. He had developed this high pitched cry.
And of course, that's very characteristic of increased cerebral pressure, which you get from an encephalitis.
Yes, and as we talked about last time, I didn't know it at the time, but in the 1977 PDR, which was the year he was born, the first three side effects listed under pertussogen, the pertussis vaccine, are death, pneumonia, and encephalitis. And he had pneumonia, and he had an encephalitis that they didn't tell me about. They treated him for pneumonia, and he was released in 8 days. But, you know, I was very naive. He was having seizures in the hospital, and, you know, my doctor released him with a clean bill of health, and when I got him home, I couldn't even feed him. He was he'd been on glucose for 8 days, and when I started feeding him again, I couldn't breastfeed, so I gave him, you know, whatever formula, and he was, you know, throwing it up across the room. This little infant that had no reflexes anymore. He had a very weak sucking reflex. I almost had to, use an eyedropper to get the formula down him. And he had all this strength to, you know, to projectile vomit his formula up across the room. And it was very frightening. I've never been more scared in my life during this whole ordeal. And I called the doctor, and he just kept telling me to change the formula. And the same thing would happen every time, even with the soy formula. And I was worried about even keeping fluids, you know, down him. So one of my friends told me about a farm outside of town, and I drove there every 2 days to get fresh goat's milk. And he started tolerating that fairly well. And but I had a totally changed baby. I had an infant that had no reflexes, just laid there. And of course I went, you know, I took him to another pediatrician there in this small town in Alaska, in Fairbanks, Alaska. And, of course, everybody knows everybody. So when I changed pediatricians, of course, they, you know, circled the wagons and said, well, there's nothing wrong with him. You know, this is your first baby. You know, just go home and love him. And I said, but he's turning orange. He's, you know, he doesn't move. He just lays there. And his, you know, his stats went, you know, went from 90, he was in the 90th percentile in everything when he started out, and he just went straight off the chart that first year, down to the 5th percentile in weight and height and everything, and head size, and I just, you know, I just barely kept body and soul together that year, and, you know, things improved somewhat after that, but he was developmentally delayed, and he's a he was mentally handicapped, and you know, he was in special ed his whole life.
What's his IQ, about 70?
70, right. And, you know, he's a delightful young man, but needless to say, that's a major challenge for any kid. And
of course, I've heard the same story from parent after parent after parent immediately after the vaccination. Now, they'll say, oh, it just happened by accident, but not that many times. In fact, I had Sherry Tenpenny on, Dr. Tenpenny, today, and I asked her if she'd ever heard stories like this. Well, of course, she deals with a lot of autistic children in her practice, and she said, I hear that story every day from a parent. My child was perfectly all right until I took it in to get it vaccinated. Now, the doctors will tell you, oh, no, no, the vaccines don't do any harm. But, you see, if they acknowledge that, then why would they be giving the vaccines? And, of course, we want to just sort of say that couldn't be true. But I'll tell you that I know some doctors will not give their children the vaccines, but they'll give them to other children because they're more or less forced to by the way that the system is set up today. So we're going to have to say goodnight to our listeners up there in the great Northwest, and we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Now, if you'd like to get a copy of this program, and we're going to be on with Sue for 2 hours this evening, or if you'd like to get a 4-tape set on vaccinations, we have these available. We carry a wonderful book, has a chapter on vaccinations called Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. And you need to know the facts, and it's written by Dr. Blaylock. He does an excellent job. He's a personal friend, neurosurgeon for many years, who felt he might be able to do more good by telling people the truth and by continuing his surgery. So Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life by Dr. Blaylock, or his other book on excitotoxins, are excellent. But our 4-tape set on vaccination, so important that you have some knowledge, of course, what's going on. Sue, do you have a website or anything you'd like to put out?
Well, if I could give you my phone number, and I have informed consent journal, I can send out at no charge.
Go ahead.
619-443-3030.
All right, that's 619-443-3030. And if you're out there listening, audience, and of course you'd like to get in touch with my ministry, Radio Liberty, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because we're involved in the spiritual battle. And what you're really seeing, what we're talking about, behind all of this, behind a lot of confusion and people who just want to get along and don't want to rock the boat in government, really are evil forces, because who'd want to hurt a child? And then, of course, lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until Monday, may the Lord be with you. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And you can give us a call if you'd like to. Our guest this evening is Sue Scherer, and we're, of course, talking about vaccines and the fact that you have not been told the truth about vaccines, that there are very, very serious dangers from vaccines, that the incidence of death from diphtheria and tetanus and pertussis had dropped dramatically long before the advent of vaccination. And by the time they got around to starting the measles vaccine, I think there were about 30 deaths a year from measles in the entire country. And of course, if those children had been treated with the intensive care that we have today, probably most of those lives could be been saved. Yes, we would occasionally have a child that would die or have some permanent damage from measles. But how many other children have we permanently damaged? And you're not hearing about it. And all we have to do is point out what's happened to the incidence of autism there from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 250,000. Certainly, I've seen the doubling of diabetes, doubling of asthma, doubling of allergies, doubling of autoimmune disease in our children in the last 15 to 20 years. But there is nobody who wants to talk about this or wants to talk about the viruses that we put in, the measles virus, of course, that lives and gets into the central nervous system and creates an autoimmune disease there, or the monkey viruses from the rhesus monkey, the monkey viruses from the green monkey. One of those viruses was a simian immunodeficiency virus, and we got these into all the people. In other words, the human beings got these viruses from the vaccines. And they say, well, gee, we didn't know there was going to be any problems from them. Well, if we can't trust them, and then they conceal the facts and today, how could we ever trust the establishment again? And you cannot trust the CDC because, of course, the one idea that is involved in working for government is don't rock the boat. Retire, and then of course, if the vote goes down after that, why, of course, that's somebody else's problem. And of course, we see now the chronic fatigue syndrome, we see fibromyalgia, we see all these new diseases and conditions, and of course, skyrocketing cancer. And that is one of the things that really concerns me. It used to be that 100 years ago, you would have maybe 1 in 30 or 40 people with cancer, and now you've got 1 in 3. What's wrong with this picture? Well, Sue, I'm sure you've looked into the relationship between the vaccines and cancer, and certainly you commented that back in, long before they ever started the vaccination program, some of the people were talking about this danger. So what's your impression, and is there any documentation of the relationship between cancer and vaccination?
Well, I've got another thing I publish. It's the Investigate Before You Vaccinate websites, and there's Michael Horwin and his son Alexander Horwin. He developed a brain tumor, and they found SV40 in his tumor. However, SV40 should not have been in any of the. He received all of his vaccines. He died at age 3. However, he should not have received SV40, but his mother would have received simian virus 40 in the 60s or 70s.
In other words, the mother would have had it, and she would have transmitted it to her child, and of course, you do give diseases from mothers to children, and this is one of the real problems, is that the children now are getting it from their parents. It's vertical transmission. That's frightening. And because we know that SV40, which is the monkey virus that was in the original Sabin vaccine, which was given to 90 million Americans, the Sabin vaccine contained SV40. Pardon me, the Salk vaccine contained the SV40, but they couldn't tell the American people that because, of course, they would be furious when they realized what a terrible mistake had been made.
And then there's the research of Dr. Michael Barone from Italy, and he also connects simian virus 40 with mesothelial tumors, and I guess those are lung cancers?
Yes, it is. It's a lining of the lung. In other words, it's the membrane that lines the pleural cavity. And that was a very, very rare tumor until, of course, recently. And it takes a long time for this to come on. And, of course, they say, well, this is due to exposure to asbestos. Well, most of these people had no contact with asbestos. In fact, there's a congressman who reads my newsletter regularly. At least I sent it to him. And he must have read this one because he called me and told me that his wife had just died of a mesothelioma. And how terrible it is to suddenly realize that maybe you lost a loved one because of this cover-up, because, of course, they did this. And when they knew it was in the simian virus 40 was in the polio vaccine, they continued giving it.
You know, back there was a time when they, you know, they started saying, hey, cancers are caused by viruses. And then you didn't hear that anymore, and they said, you know, there was another explanation for cancer. And, but of course, you know, but of course viruses can cause cancer. And we're seeing that all over. There was a study showing where they found measles vaccine viruses in the lesions of multiple sclerosis patients. And, you know, you don't hear too much about that, but anytime somebody does a study like that, you're not going to get government funding to do a follow-up study on that. That may be the
that may be your last study you'll
that
ever
may be
do.
Your last, that may be the last study you'll ever do. Along that same vein, there was a researcher at UC Irvine, Dr. Al Allen, and he did a study on chronic fatigue syndrome. And he collected, he had a group of, I'm not sure how large the group was, but at any rate, he did blood titers on several different vaccine viruses. And the one most significant was rubella, the rubella titer. And what he showed was that when these, usually women have chronic fatigue, but at any rate, when these subjects were experiencing their symptoms, in other words, they couldn't get out of bed or they were really symptomatic, that's when the antibody titer, rubella antibodies would be at their highest level. And then there were four or five other vaccine viruses that he also tested, and they also followed this same pattern for all of the subjects. He had 100% correlation, and of course it was more dramatic with rubella antibodies. But he told me, I talked to him over the phone, and he said, I've also got an AIDS drug that I'm working on, but he says, I don't have any confidence in it, but the drug companies are calling me, telling me they want this, they want to give me some money, they want to get this going, and I'm telling them, well, it's not ready. I don't know if we even have anything here. And but his study that has 100% correlation with the rubella and chronic fatigue, he can't get anybody to a follow-up on. He can't get any money for that.
Well, of course, think of the implication of that, because, of course, we, of course, give every child rubella, mumps, and measles vaccine together, but the vaccine is live viruses, isn't it?
It's called
attenuated viruses. And, of course, by attenuating the virus, supposedly, you're going to develop a normal immune response to that. The body's going to kill the viruses, and then you're not going to get your measles, mumps, and rubella. But what happens if the body doesn't kill the viruses? What if the attenuated viruses then, of course, get into your brain tissue? And, of course, this is actually what they're finding now. And you're not hearing about. About 20% of the children, of course, that take the vaccination, the body does not kill the measles vaccine. Now, I don't know about the rubella and the mumps, but I suspect that from what you're describing, these other are just as much of a problem. And then, of course, you know, those are with you all the rest of your life. All the rest of your life because, of course, you took the vaccination or your parents gave it to you because they were told to.
And you, actually, you know, it may be just, you might find this very interesting. Reuters, Lancet, and Virology just have published studies showing that, you know, when you have several different polio strains in a vaccine, and they these studies that they're doing show that these polio viruses recombine and they produce more virulent strains that cause paralysis. And I've also been reading that polio didn't cause paralysis before the turn of the century or before World War I. That a paralysis connected with polio is a fairly recent development. And, you know, going along with what you said about the Gulf War illness, we had a very short involvement in World War I. We got in rather late. And so we didn't suffer that many actual casualties from the war. However, there was the worldwide flu epidemic that year, and the disinformation that the government put out at first was our boys were getting the Spanish flu and they were bringing it home, and we all had to get vaccinated against the stuff that our guys were bringing home.
Now, was that back in 1918, 1919?
Yes. And what you never hear is that there was this tremendous vaccination program, and it was all based on, you know, even though they'd only been over there a short time, they were exposed to the Spanish influenza, is what they called it at first. That was the first disinformation that they put out. And so, according to Eleanor McBean in her book, there were massive vaccination programs, and her family, of course, her parents, didn't vaccinate. I don't know if they were, you know, connected with chiropractic or whatever, but they were non-vaccinators. And in her small town, they were practically the only people, or they were the only people who could minister to everybody else and help bury everybody else. But they were actually getting people well. And some of the treatment they had for the flu wasn't real good either. So they had a high, you know, that was a high death rate. That was 40 to 60 million people worldwide. But she claims, it's her contention, that that was a, you know, that was a man-made vaccine-induced epidemic. And I know she's pretty, you know, extreme, some might say. But she also, in her book, mentions that in Germany, Hitler had a massive vaccination program. And just like the Africans said, food and water, held up a sign, food and water, yes, vaccines, no. The German people, when we went in to occupy Germany, you know, of course, the first thing they do, you know, even before they get, you know, get everything else moving, they get hospitals and they get vaccine programs going. And the German people said, please, please, we've had enough of that. Just, you know, just don't anything. Just no more vaccine programs. And that's in Eleanor McBean's book, The Poison Needle. And the Reuters, Lancet, and Virology study are in Neil Miller's updated vaccines. Are they really safe and effective?
I'm sorry. Now, Eleanor McBean's book, The Poison Needle, and what was the other one you said?
Neil Miller's book, vaccines, are they really safe and effective? It's his new revised edition, just came out a few months ago. And he's had that book out for over 10 years, but he just updated it. And that's some of the new information that he had. And I've read it other places, too, that paralysis has not traditionally been connected with polio.
Well, now, what was the disease if it didn't produce polio? And certainly, we did see the paralysis, you know, because I treated a lot of the residual of that, you know, in the 1960s, 1950s, when I was taking my orthopedic training.
Well, they're saying turn of the century or World War One. Prior to that, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a paralytic disease.
I see. Well, okay.
And that goes along with there's a whole study. You can induce paralysis after a DPT shot. There's a large study. It's a collection of individual studies showing paralysis after a DPT shot. And I've actually interviewed a fellow realtor here in town that her sister got polio right after a DPT shot, somewhat, you know, like just the same as the opportunistic meningitis after vaccination.
Okay, well, there are lots of things out there that we don't understand. If you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And now there's a lot of things about vaccines that most people don't know. Now, one of the things is that, of course, the DPT, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, and tetanus. The real problems, of course, the diphtheria and the tetanus were not made of the bacteria. They were made of the toxins that the bacteria produced. And, of course, an antitoxin or a substance that would bind the toxin would, of course, relieve you of getting these complications of diphtheria. But then, of course, with pertussis, it was not a toxin, although certainly when you get the disease, why the toxicity is what really gets you into problems. But they simply took the bacteria and they ground them all up, and they grew them and ground them up, and they used these sort of a whole bacteria as the basis of their vaccine. And this was terribly toxic, and it produced encephalitis. This was the problem, and that was where you really got into problem with the DPT, maybe because the thimerosal there as well. But this is where a lot of people, early before we had the MMR vaccine, that's where they got their autism, and that's what happened to Barbara Lowe Fisher's, and that's why she spent the rest of her life trying to get the truth out about vaccines, because her son, of course, was a victim of a DPT shot, and just very, very shortly after he had it, why, of course, his whole veneer activity changed, and he became autistic. And, of course, this is the great, great tragedy, and yet, on the other hand, I believe Barbara Lowe Fisher and people like you, Sue, are having an impact, because I think more and more people out there are beginning to question what's going on and realize we're not getting the entire truth. And when they first hear it, they sneer, and they hear it the second or third time, or then they hear a story like yours or Barbara Lowe Fisher's, or maybe it happens to a friend of theirs, and they suddenly realize that this really is true, there really are complications, and of course there's an organized effort to conceal the truth from the American people. So I know that there's more and more awareness of this than there was even 5 years ago. Don't you see that?
Yes, I do. I do. You know, Neil Miller and others also say changed the diagnostic procedures for polio after introduction of the vaccine. In other words, meningitis. All of a sudden, what they used to diagnose as polio becomes cerebral palsy, meningitis, and some other things. But, you know, so
the thing is that the clinical picture of polio is really pretty characteristic. And of course, I took care of people with orthopedic problems, and you know, the polio, of course, you'd have a flaccid arm or leg that would usually be the picture. Of course, you could have paralyzed respiratory muscles too, but we just didn't see this, after the polio vaccine came in. It really did knock out the polio, but of course, at what cost? And that's the question,
yeah.
And of course, polio was a terrible disease. Only a small part of the people got it. When they got it, it was devastating, as it was, for instance, for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was a very robust individual, and suddenly he's stricken with polio, and he's really confined to a wheelchair. He can only stand up with braces and barely walk at all without a great deal of support, and then only for a very, very few feet. So, I mean, this was a terrible, terrible disease. And although bringing it under control is a great and amazing thing, what was the cost to humanity? And I would like to suggest that maybe they've done a lot more harm than good by what they've done.
Yes, I think, we went past vaccine safety way too fast. I mean, a 5-day study is not long enough to determine if something is safe. And as Barbara Lowe Fisher says, the longest term study on a vaccine before a licensure study is 5 days. There's longer studies. They practice what they call post-marketing surveillance. But even when, we tell them, hey, you're hurting our kids, they don't listen to parents. That's anecdotal evidence. They don't do anything with their own data, with the VAERS data. The CDC doesn't do anything with the deaths that are reported to them. It's just a wastebasket. Your kid dies and you report it to CDC, nothing, absolutely nothing happens.
Well, have you seen this latest study by Dr. Mark Geyer, where he has analyzed all of the VAERS studies?
No, but I heard him on your program, and I haven't familiarized myself with the study, but I remember hearing him on your program.
Well, of course, when he was on my program, we were talking primarily about thimerosal and MMR, but apparently he has done a recent study of all the VAERS reports going back, I think, 10 years, something like that. Now, for our listeners, the VAERS reports refers to the vaccine adverse activity replies,
adverse events reporting system.
Events reporting system, okay. So VAERS. Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. And, of course, this is set up, and anybody can report, but probably only maybe 10% of adverse responses get reported. And he said he's gone over the 250,000 of them. And, of course, over a 10-year period, if that's only 10%, we're talking about, maybe 2.5 million reactions to vaccines. And nobody, of course, is really, of course, very concerned about it. And certainly the companies know that there's real problems. That's why they insisted on getting legislation, which, of course, prevented them from being sued. And why would you want to give your child a vaccine if you knew the manufacturer would not produce it unless, of course, he could get a get-out-of-jail-free or get-out-of-liability-free card from the government? Let's go to Ray, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Ray. How are you doing?
Hi, wonderful show. And I just want to mention something that scared the hell out of me, and I want to mention it to see if you two know about it. There was a series of articles in the San Francisco Chronicle some months ago, and the man who was a critic of the polio vaccine said he has documentation that lymphoma cancers doubled after the polio vaccines. In other words, after that first wave of polio vaccines, the late 50s, early 60s, lymphomas doubled, and he has absolute proof of it.
I'm sure that it did, and whether it could very well be related to that, because many of the original polio vaccine contained a cancer-producing virus, and I know it produces mesotheliomas and brain tumors. And Sue, do you recall if SV40 produces lymphomas? I almost think it does. Do you know that?
I can't recall, but I'm just. A lymphoma is a skin cancer?
Lymphoma is a tumor of the lymph nodes.
The lymph nodes.
The lymphatic system, right.
No, I don't have that. What I have is that it causes brain tumors, bone cancers, lung cancers.
Well, I know about that, but this gentleman had gone a step further. He claims that it also caused lymphomas. In other words, and I remember something he said in one of the articles. He said Jackie Kennedy probably died from her polio vaccine.
Well,
really, yeah.
And of course, the question would be, is that related to the SV40? Because we know...
Oh, yes, sir,
cancer,
yeah.
He thinks it's from the SV40, then.
Yes, sir, yes, all sir. Right. He mentioned SV40 over and over again, and he said he thinks that's the culprit, and that caused lymphoma cancers to double.
It could very well be. And of course, this is, you know, this is an amazing organism. If it was the first cancer-producing virus that was identified, in fact, it was so important that the whole field of genetic engineering centered around SV40 was the first organism that they ever did the genetic coding on, because they wanted to find which one of the genes in SV40 actually produced the cancer. So they know it's a cancer-producing virus, but how are you going to tell the people that?
Well, Dr. Monteith, another thing he said which stayed in my mind, he called SV40 a sturdy warrior virus, which is the most carcinogenic he's ever come across.
And I'm sure he's absolutely right. And they've known it, but how are you going to tell the American people that? Why, we'd lose confidence in these people, wouldn't we?
Oh, my God.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, Ray. Okay, and of course, Ray, I think he's absolutely right, and I wish I had those articles. I didn't see those. But, of course, once in a while, the newspapers actually carry the truth. That's why I read them. And I will go through, six newspapers we get about every day, different newspapers. And, of course, I read them all. And maybe there'll be a half a dozen articles that are worthwhile, and all the rest of them are propaganda or a CIA disinformation or planted articles to get you off the track. But once in a while, they'll let the truth slip through. And then, of course, we've got to be able to interpret that. So, I think it's a frightening thing as we see what we've wrought. And they're getting away with it, and they ask us to continue trusting them. And we're not going to trust them until the people who are responsible are brought before the bar of justice. Because if they were really interested in solving this problem, they would hold the people who have been covering this thing up all this time responsible. These are crimes against humanity. And you could say, well, it was just a mistake. We didn't know. But the cover-up hasn't been a mistake. Certainly not. Well, Sue, what can we do to get the information out? Now, of course, you talk on radio programs, and you have a website, and you go ahead and try to reach people. What's the most effective means we have of getting the American people to know what's been going on?
Well, I don't know if I know the answer to that. I talk to a lot of people one-on-one. It's not always welcome. They always don't want to hear what I have to say, but I feel like it's life and death, and I have to say something. And we're just a small operation here.
No, of course but you see, what we need is a lot of small operations, not big operations. If you have a big operation, they'll infiltrate it and take it over. And I've seen this
exactly.
With the conservative organizations. I've seen it with the religious organizations. And that's why, we are completely independent of everybody else. And everybody says, oh, come on, join my organization. I don't want to join their organization. There's somebody else may very well take that over and begin moving in the wrong direction. So what we need, and the strength of what we do, is we are a network, a loose network of literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people across America. And that really is the strength of the New Age movement. In fact, there's a book called The Aquarian Conspiracy by Marilyn Ferguson, who talks about the New Age or occult movement, and she talks about a network. And I think we do far more good networking than simply giving our allegiance to an organization, because we don't know when the leader is going to be replaced, and of course it's going to go off in the other direction. I see this in, for instance, so many of these organizations for chronic fatigue syndrome that start out really trying to help the people of chronic fatigue, and then pretty soon they're taking government money, and then pretty soon, why, they're no longer effective at all. Same thing happened with the prisoner of war organizations that trying to find out what happened to the boys we abandoned after the Second World War and after Korea and after Vietnam. And, of course, their organizations were taken over, and, of course, now they do absolutely nothing of any use at all. Everybody feels good as if something's being done, but if you look at it, why, it's all an act of frustration, as that's exactly what they want. But we're going to be back here right after the break, and, of course, we'll welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY and 464-8295. If you have anything to contribute, if you have any disagreement, if you have a question, give us a call right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Sue Schur. And of course, Sue is on the front lines of this battle to try to awaken people to the dangers of vaccinations, with the realization that there are new vaccines coming down the line, the fact that they're forcing, literally forcing, parents to allow their child to be given hepatitis B in the nursery. And I'm going to get your impression of that. How do you feel about the government policy that says you have to have your child vaccinated in the nursery, at the hospital, right after being born, for hepatitis B, because we're from the government and we're here to protect them? How do you respond to that?
Well, hepatitis B, a newborn baby is not at risk for hepatitis B. That's a no-brainer.
Unless mother is has hepatitis B, and you're sure she had.
Well, I would treat the organism first of all, and treat the baby and treat the mother as individual organisms. Vaccine programs, there's no such thing as public health, period. There's the health of the organism, the health of the individual, and like Jane Oriens says, you can't have public health. If you do, that's when you try to have public health, you create a monster. That's what they've done, and you use taxpayers' dollars to do it. And the resources that we could be using to be actually practicing medicine are being wasted on these public health programs, in my opinion.
All right, well, now what's wrong with the hepatitis B vaccine? After all, if later on, of course, they were to become promiscuous or be in a relationship with somebody who had hepatitis B, they might get hepatitis B when they're 18 or 19 years old. So what's wrong with giving them the vaccine at a young age so we're sure that they're vaccinated and they'll be safe as they grow up?
Well, they give it to them in when they're 14 and 15 anyway. So why give it to them at 12 hours old? That's anywhere after 12 hours they can give that hepatitis B shot.
Well, are you suggesting that parents shouldn't tell the hospital they do not want to have that shot done? Because they're doing it automatically now.
I suggest that parents emphatically tell the hospital that they're delaying any vaccinations, and that if it were me, I would tell I wouldn't have my child in the hospital, but if I did, I would tell them we have a history of vaccine reactions in the family, and there's a medical reason for not vaccinating my child. And I wouldn't get into politics with them or anything.
We're not talking about the people in the hospital now. We're talking, what are you going to tell a parent or somebody who is going to have a child? Why should they not have that hepatitis B vaccine in the nursery? Why should they not have the follow-up? What's wrong with the hepatitis B vaccine?
Well, it's a recombinant vaccine. And it's genetically engineered. It's man-made. That should make you suspicious right there. It's had over 20,000 serious reactions, including Jesse Ventura's daughter, Jade, had a severe reaction with seizures. If you want an infant, if you want the infant the way that you delivered it, and you want to nurture it, then you're safe. If you want to try and prevent everything, you're going to be using these products that that involve a great deal of money to somebody that you're not going to get the benefit of actually preventing anything. And you might end up with a big problem because these things aren't tested fully. And when they test a vaccine, there's no double-blind study. The control group gets another vaccine. So all they're comparing is one group with vaccine A to another group with vaccine B. And so there's never actually a comparison done with in a licensure study with a non-vaccinated control group. If there was, they'd find out. they'd have some dramatic results, and they'd realize the non-vaccinated group is always healthier. In veterinary practice, any holistically oriented vet will tell you that their non-vaccinated animals are healthier, and breeders that have show dogs that have to that have to have dogs at top for performance, they do everything they can to avoid rabies vaccination, including lying about it, and because a dog or a cat that's been vaccinated with rabies, oftentimes, not all the time, but they can, it affects their nervous system, and you can't have an aggressive dog, and you can't have a nervous dog if you're showing dogs, and dog breeders know that, and they go out of their way not to vaccinate individuals that they're going to, show professionally.
Well, I think the thing about the hepatitis B vaccine is that, as Sue says, this is a genetically engineered vaccine, and basically they have one gene. It's a molecule, and of course that ordinarily is found on the shell of the hepatitis B virus, and so if they can give that to people, why, they will develop antibodies to that that molecule. The trouble is that the molecule or the gene that they have just has certain similarities to the myelin sheath that surrounds the nerves of the central nervous system, both the brain and the spinal cord and the peripheral nerves. So what you get is something called molecular mimicking. Molecular meaning, of course, this is a molecule we're dealing with, and mimicking is that something looks just like something else. And the body, of course, it develops an immune response to this this molecule that they put in, this gene from hepatitis B. You give that, of course, so the body will then mobilize. So if you get the hepatitis B vaccine, pardon me, the hepatitis B virus, the body will attack it automatically. The trouble is that because of the similarity between the gene that they immunize you with and your own myelin sheath, your immune system begins to attack you, and you get an autoimmune disease. Now, I was told this by Dr. Bonnie Dunbar, who's one of the world's leading authorities on the vaccines. Do you know her at all, Sue?
Yes, I do. I've heard her speak, and she got involved. She's a vaccine inventor herself. She's holds several patents on vaccines. She's not a non-vaccinator, but her brother, in order to work in her lab, received a hepatitis B vaccination and had a chronic illness from that.
And he did. I mean, he took the hepatitis B and he was wiped out.
Yes.
And of course, this is what you have to understand. So Bonnie's a fascinating individual to talk to, and basically she creates vaccines for animals. And do you know that, for instance, they can create a vaccine that will keep elephants from reproducing? It'll make the females sterile, and they spray it on them. I mean, how do you run up and give an elephant a vaccination? And of course, in certain parts of the world, and maybe in Botswana and certain parts of Africa and Mozambique, why, of course, they have too many elephants, so they just go over them with a little airplane. They spray this out the window, and of course, the female elephant will not conceive. And that's the sort of thing that she does, and same things you can do with animals, the lions or whatever else you want. And so she's very much pro-vaccine. But, of course, she's very aware, of course, of this hepatitis B. And she told me, I talked to her, she told me she had her life threatened for, and she's not going to get on the air and say that, but I'll say, tell you what she told me. She said she had her life threatened for daring to try to get the truth out about hepatitis B vaccine. Now, why? Because this is a big moneymaker. There is absolutely no reason to give it to a child in the United States. But, of course, when you're getting it, do you have any idea what that costs today, Sue, for those shots?
No, I don't. What it costs to produce them?
No,
or
what it costs, what they charge the people for the vaccine.
I imagine if you go to your doctor, it's a $40, you know, $40,
$50. And is that for the vaccine or is that for the shot and the vaccine?
I think that's the administering the shot is another.
So anyway, there's a lot of money to be made in this. There's absolutely no justification. I believe it's medical malpractice to give it unless the mother is proven to have hepatitis B, and then we could debate whether or not we wanted to do that or not. But at least with that one exception, there is no justification to do it, and yet they insisted on giving it in the nursery, and then I don't know what the three shots. So there's a lot of money to be made, and you think, well, you're just crass. How could you say anybody would want to make money? Well, let me tell you, of course, that it costs a good deal of money for every shot in the United States. But in China, why, they'll give it for a dollar a shot. In other words, they can manufacture it and sell it over there at a profit for a dollar. And, of course, they've got to give it to everybody over there because in China there are 700 million Chinese. That's 700 million Chinese, over half of the population of that 1.25 billion people over there have had hepatitis B. How did they get it? Why, vaccination shots using dirty needles. So the vaccine program in China, of course, using dirty needles over and over again, spread hepatitis B, and now they've got a terrible problem, and now, of course, they're going to have to give them the hepatitis B vaccine with all the problems inherent in it. But, there, of course, there may be a justification for its use, but not here in the United States. So why are they giving it here? Why to subsidize what's going on all throughout the world where they, of course, are making up, trying to correct the problem they've already created? Wouldn't be a lot better off if we just hadn't given it in the beginning. Let's go, and we have Kurt calling. Hi, Kurt. How are you doing?
Fine.
Where are you calling from?
Rio Del Mar.
Rio Del Mar. Okay, good to have you with us.
Yeah, had a couple questions about different diseases possibly related to viruses. I got in 1988 or 89 here in Aptos, I picked up Lyme disease. And I went to my hospital, my HMO up in Santa Clara, and I was only the fourth case they'd seen with a positive Lyme titers. And their treatment didn't work, but I went to Dr. Petrali here in Santa Cruz. I guess he's passed away now.
He passed away, but he was a good friend and a wonderful, wonderful Christian gentleman.
Oh, was he? Yeah, he was sure a fantastic guy and a wonderful doctor.
Right.
And he gave me a treatment that worked, and then a friend of mine up in Santa Rosa took it all, and he also had it cured.
What did he do for you, just for my curiosity?
I forget the antibiotic, but it was a 20-day course. I understand it's supposed to be a 21-day course. And on the 16th day, I was sitting in a chair, grabbing the arms, trembling and shaking it, and going, I will finish this course. I will. And I just chanted that all day long and hung on for the last 4 days. But when it was over, I was cured of Lyme disease. Well, there's a Lyme disease support group here in Santa Cruz. And I guess when you go to the meetings, they asked me to speak because I had gotten rid of it. And they have so many people that don't. I'd like to see you do a show on it sometime.
If you have anybody who's really knowledgeable, I would be glad to.
Oh, yeah, I'll connect you with
them. Do you know, of course, why they call it Lyme disease?
Oh, well, it was first discovered in Lyme, Connecticut.
And do you know where Lyme, Connecticut is? It's just across the inlet from Plum Island. And what's on Plum Island?
Oh, gee.
By a government, of course. A biocontamination special laboratory they have there. In fact, the Plum Island has just been taken over by the Office of Homeland Security. Go up on the website, type in Plum Island and get the articles. But go ahead.
Oh, my. Well, now out here, when I went to the support group and spoke, there are these people with walkers and those canes like they had for polio, and then neck braces and body braces. I mean, it looks, it's unbelievable. And these
right.
people are suffering, they're horribly suffering, their lives have been just destroyed by it. And they're saying that some of the disease that piggybacks with it, I think it's called babesiosis. Now, is there any connection with these two diseases and vaccinations? And then I've got one about another disease.
Well, I do you have a comment on that, Sue?
I'm interested in the cure because I have a friend that has Lyme disease and she hasn't been successful. But secondly, I know the Lyme disease support person, the main support group in the nation, spoke at the last NVIC conference, and they tried to take over her organization if she would endorse a Lyme disease vaccine, and they looked at it, they said it doesn't work, so they refused the endorsement, and they had all their funding pulled by, I forget who was attempting a takeover.
Well, the vaccine, you know, if you've had Lyme disease like I have, you know, there's no way you can tell whether it does any good or something. I forget. There's quite a support group, Dr. Stan. I'll try to refer them on to you. What is your email?
I'll tell you what. I'm going to put you on to give you back.
I'll get that there.
And she will give it to you.
Okay.
She will give it to you. But if we give it out over the air, this is a secret email, and so
okay.
I don't want it to get out.
All right. Now, the other one is...
But I would like to do some programs on Lyme disease. There's a lot I don't know about. Let me just tell you one thing I do know, and that is I've done, within the last week, two interviews with Dr. John Martin. And Dr. Martin was a professor at USC. He was in charge of the laboratory at the Los Angeles County Hospital, one of the largest county hospitals in the whole world, and a leading expert in this. But of course, he talked about some of these monkey viruses that came from the vaccine, and they brought pressure on the university and upon him, and he even endorsed Len Horowitz's book on emerging viruses going into the real background of the AIDS. And he's been under tremendous pressure, and he couldn't get any more of his grants. Anyway, but talking to him early this morning, he was talking about, he believes that some of these monkey viruses that were introduced from the green monkeys, the polio vaccine, play a part in chronic Lyme disease. So there may be a cofactors. I don't know all the answers. Maybe we can get him on, but I would like to talk to some people. If you can get me any experts on it, I'd love to get them on.
Well, what I'll do is I'll get the Lyme support group I'll forward some of their emails to you.
All right, fine.
And then you can contact that.
Okay, I will put you on hold. Is there
anything
you
can tell me? Yeah, there's a couple other things. Yes, there's a little bit more on Lyme.
Go ahead.
And some of the stories they tell about Lyme is how doctors in New York have been threatened, they've lost their licenses. I guess what was happening, if I have the story correct, is that the insurance companies would challenge their competency and then the doctors would lose their licenses for treating Lyme. So there's evidently some kind of conspiracy to keep Lyme from being treated because it's so expensive to treat. The other disease I'm wondering about is the candidiasis, which I think is one of the largest health problems in America, and it's just ignored.
Mm-hmm. That's a chronic yeast infection, usually in the intestine and the mouth, okay?
Yes, and I've seen a number of people that have been virtually crippled with that disease. Is that possibly related to vaccinations?
I would not want to comment on that, but I will tell you that, of course, vaccination actually influences your immune system, and people get candidiasis because they have an altered immune system. And the important thing to do is to build up your immunity so your body can take care of this.
Well, my understanding is that both candidiasis and Lyme disease attack the immune system
right.
and weaken the immune system.
Absolutely. And but then, of course, what you have to do is figure out how to increase your immunity so your body can ordinarily deal with viruses and funguses and bacteria if it's working right. And if it's not working right, then they get the best of you. Do you have any thoughts on that, Sue?
Yeah, I know that what you're saying is absolutely right. And, of course, antibiotics... you know, before 1960, antibiotics were used, you know, judiciously, and after that they were used on everything. And so antibiotics, of course, have something to do with candida overgrowth.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to put you on...
Well, one last quick comment. You'd mentioned animals.
Right.
And I have a little tiny cat, and she's indoor cat only, and she had a fibrous sarcoma, I believe is the proper term for it. And I brought her to the vet, and I cut that out. But the vet told me, he said, the vaccine we gave her as a kitten to prevent certain diseases the cats outside get is quite frequently a cause of cancer in animals and the cats.
Right.
And if I had known that, she never would have had that vaccination.
I know. Well, of course, I wish you could go through some of these volumes that we're getting. These they're called the Special Virus Cancer Project. They were tied into the CIA and the National Institute of Cancer, NIC. And of course, orders were given to have them all destroyed back in 1973 because they didn't want any of them to survive. And fortunately, a few did survive, and I've got a couple of them, or at least copies of them. And you should see the experiments they were doing with these animal sarcoma viruses and lymphoma viruses and growing them in human beings and, organized madness or something far more sinister.
Well, this sounds like Ishii in Manchuria.
Absolutely.
Or Mengele.
Right. Well, remember, there are a lot of people who believe in Mengele. I've talked to these five people who say that they knew Mengele here. I've talked to Dr. Colin Ross, who deals with people of victims of CIA mind control, and he said rather reluctantly over the radio, yes, I had talked with a number of people who said that they'd met Mengele here in the United States. Could it be true?
I talked to one of your guests personally, and she said that she'd seen Mengele twice.
Right. Well, okay, well, we're going to put you on the line here, Chris.
Yeah, thank you.
And hang on, we'll be right and. Jeannie, if you wouldn't mind, either get Kurt's telephone number, or if you know my email, my secret email, you can give it to him, okay? God bless, and bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay, fine. Sue, we've only got a few more minutes here, and of course, is there anybody else out there in the listening audience who would actually like to come on? Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And the subject of Lyme disease is something I don't know that much about. I'd like to learn more about it. But, you know, there's much more here than meets the eye. And it's sort of like chronic fatigue. And everything has been done to discourage treatment. In fact, to try to find out what chronic fatigue really is. And if those of you who have never read the book Osler's Web by Hilary Johnson, my friend Don Scott told me one of the finest books he'd ever read. Well, I've read a lot of really fine books, but I got hold of the book and I read it, and I will tell you, it's one of the most intriguing books I've ever read. It's all true. It's the story of the chronic fatigue epidemic that, of course, began in the United States, and, of course, it began here. Now the disease is seen throughout the world. But, of course, everything that was done to block any effort to find out what was behind it and, of course, develop any treatment, and how, of course, the people got the Congress to appropriate all sorts of money, and the CDC refused to spend the money. And you wonder, why would they refuse to spend the money that was appropriated specifically to try to find out what's behind chronic fatigue syndrome? Well, as you read the book, you begin to get the idea that there's a much bigger picture or much bigger story here than have been told. And as I say, I believe some of the chronic fatigue organizations have been taken over, just as you were saying that, you know, there's been efforts to take over the Lyme organizations. Why? I mean, why are they trying to keep people from getting treated? Do you have any ideas, Sue?
Well, we can only surmise that they don't want them to get well. And they don't want them to find the cause, the actual cause of their illnesses.
Now, wouldn't that be something, if there really is something out there that somebody is actively suppressing, somebody with a great deal of power? The book, Osler's Web, I suggest you get it. We've only, I think, got three or four more of them. We got in about 20 of them. I only got them because one of our listeners found some and got them to me, and we offer them to you. It's an inexpensive book. But Osler's Web by Hilary Johnson. And it will change the way you look, certainly, at chronic fatigue, and maybe the way you look at the world. If you have any question that some of the things we're talking about really are true, there really are people out there who have a different worldview and have a different agenda. Well, and certainly it's been a fascinating 2 hours, Sue. And what is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners tonight?
Well, just I'd like to say a couple things about SARS and kind of go back to that 1918 flu epidemic. According to Eleanor McBean in The Poison Needle, that 1918 flu microorganism was man-made because it had the nucleus of one organism with the outer wall of another organism. So, now let's come up to, you know, the last year with the smallpox program. As soon as the war on terror was in full gear, the smallpox vaccine was trotted out, even though, you know, smallpox is eradicated in this country. But we have a new enemy now who can strike at any time. So the Dryvax, which is basically the same thing that Jenner had, well, first of all, we've got to have money to make new vaccine, and then we find some old vaccine in the bottom of a locker somewhere, and we, you know, we purchase that, and then we tell everybody, well, there's only going to be one or two deaths per million, and then it's up to maybe 20 deaths per million you can expect. But we've got to do this because we've got this larger threat looming. And then they actually start vaccinating, and before they've vaccinated a million people, just a few thousand first responders, or let's say 20,000 or so first responders, they've already got 20 deaths. Well, that messes up their statistics. So what do we do? All of a sudden, that same day that they report the 20, 30 smallpox deaths, that's the day that the focus is off of that and onto SARS. SARS was trotted out that same day. And I just submit to you that's the real purpose of SARS, is to take our minds off of the fact that we were lied to about the number of deaths that we could expect from smallpox. And, you know, in my opinion, one death is too many. You know, that risk is not really worth it.
Well, the thing is, if there really were smallpox or a massive smallpox outbreak in the world, I could understand that there would be a rationale, at least for ring vaccinating around that area. But we're told there is no smallpox, and yet we've got to vaccinate everybody because the wicked Saddam Hussein or the wicked Osama bin Laden may do it. They got all the experts from all over the United States to a special meeting there at the Centers for Disease Control, and they suggested that there was no justification for vaccinating anything more than at the most 50,000 people. 50,000 first responders, and they weren't even very happy about doing that. And so then, of course, Dr. Tommy Thompson and Dr. George Bush reversed that and said, well, we're going to do a million people, and then it was 10 million people, and we're going to offer this to people, and they started sending this out, and all of the people who work in the hospitals were supposed to get it. And I think at the most they've got 30,000 people. And the rest of them said, no way, Jose, we're not going to do this.
But they spent our money on 286 million doses.
I know, and of course, there is something behind this whole thing. I don't know what it is, but I've been at this game long enough to know that we're not getting the truth. We're out of time. Do you realize the 2 hours has just sped by here, Sue? It's been a fascinating time.
Great, yeah. Thank you, Dr. Stan.
God bless you. And again, let's get that telephone number of yours out.
619-443-3030.
All right, that's 619-443-3030. God bless you, Sue. Thanks so much for being with us.
God bless you, Dr. Stan.
And, of course, there are some real problems. We don't have all the answers, but we got a lot of questions. Just tell others about the program. Get our 4-tape set on vaccines, Dr. Blaylock's book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life, Pray for America and Pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and our protection.